Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And as many of you probably know, KSFR is moving up the dial to 101.1 FM, which will be our new home. When you tune into 101.1 FM, please let us know if you have any trouble whatsoever with the signal. We're still working it out and tweaking, and if you have any comments on its goodness or badness, you can write to info@ksfr.org and let us know. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with the folks from the Living Wage Coalition. It's our one day after Labor Day show. And we're also going to hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg. Right now, I would like to welcome Cheryl Russell. She is with the Kivira Coalition and Tanya Laveta with the Farm to Table. Welcome, ladies.
Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Let's talk about, first of all, the Kivira Coalition. This is an organization that's about 10 years old.
Yes, we had our 10th anniversary this year with the celebration just a couple of weeks ago.
And what do you do?
We're a nonprofit that initially was born out of the desire to bring some sort of common ground to the controversy that existed, especially in southern New Mexico, around grazing on public lands. So the founders, three people out of the Sierra Club, came together thinking that there had to be another way to approach it. And
another way besides?
Besides yelling at each other and pointing fingers.
Oh, that always works.
Yes. That's what we found. The whole idea was that the common ground that joined everyone was the interest in the health of the land. And as long as we agreed on that, then you could bring organizations together that had diverse points of view and develop programs where they could work together.
I suppose the bottom line is, if you overgraze, then the land's not good for anybody.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that really is the basis for our organization in so many ways. Now we've moved into local food production because it's our feeling that if you don't take care of the soil, the land, and be good stewards of the land, that the products that come off of it aren't going to sustain you or your consumers.
So what did the coalition do initially to bring people together? What kind of activities, what kind of conversations, and what came out of it?
Actually, community meetings. We had tremendous support. We eventually found from organizations like the Forest Service, BLM, because they all were interested in the same thing as well. And lacking infinite resources, we're delighted to have an organization try to help them bring the disparate groups together. So it was just sitting down around tables, which is kind of an old approach to problems, but, you know, something, it's the one that works, I think.
And what came out of it?
All sorts of different programs, everything from riparian restoration on private lands as well as Forest Service and BLM lands, where we actually come together with volunteers from the community. We have people coming from Albuquerque down to Cumata to move rocks and pound stakes and weave willows because they wanted to understand how they could impact the land just by using the materials that lay around. So we pride ourselves on using the native materials to try to slow water down. If you can slow water down, you're going to have more grass. If you have more grass, then you can manage grazing. But all of this had to work together in a program. So we would introduce managed grazing techniques as well as riparian restoration. We're working in the Valle Vidal now. I'm afraid it's gotten a lot of attention recently on Comanche Creek because scientists have determined that it's a pretty good idea to help restore the cutthroat trout by poisoning the stream. It's a very controversial area, but we're not involved in that piece. We're involved in slowing the water down by inducing meandering. And if the water,
what do you mean by inducing meandering?
Streams want to meander. They want to themselves to make S's across the land. When they meander and they're not interfered with by building railroads or roads that carry cars, then the water will slowly go across the land, causing it to drain hydrate into the soil more frequently. And if it slows down and the water is caught on the land, then the vegetation improves. But the other thing which had to be introduced in Comanche Creek was the inhibiting of grazing by cattle as well as elk. There's a huge population of elk there. They eat the willows. The willows would have been shadowing the stream and cooling the water down. When they're gone, then the water heated up and the cutthroat trout had a difficult time. So all of these issues are very complex, and all the little pieces that fit together into a solution can be affected by a number of different organizations.
It is often talked about that there's sort of a cultural divide between northern and southern New Mexico, and that there's a divide between ranchers and environmentalists. You are bringing these together. What does that look like? Is it true? I mean, the media like to create conflict or at least report on conflict, yes, sometimes even to an exaggerated degree.
I think the best example is to come to our conference in January, because there's the guy with the ponytail and the Birkenstocks sitting right next to the guy with the big cowboy hat and the cowboy boots, and they're all talking about the same thing, that they want to improve the health of the land.
Is there mutual respect? Is there mutual listening? Did that have to be cultivated at a certain point?
Absolutely. And yes, it did have to be cultivated. But once you get people to sit down and talk about what they really find motivating in their work and their lives, et cetera, and not what they think the other guy is thinking, to really communicate directly, it goes away. We're not news anymore, and I think that's the best example of our success. I mean, many publications will say to us, "Oh, do we have to cover that again? I mean, you're getting everybody talking. That's not news anymore," and it's a little bit frustrating to that extent.
We're talking to Cheryl Russell of the Kivira Coalition. I think probably a lot of people don't know that there is a quote unquote progressive ranching movement.
That may be true. I suppose I think we've spread the word a great deal with events just like this one, which is an outgrowth of an event that we had last year, and we feel so strongly that in building that consensus and understanding that there's a progressive ranching movement, the opportunity to just talk to each other about products, meats. You know, it really makes a tremendous impact on people's understanding of what is actually a tradition and cultural way of life here in New Mexico, and it's all over New Mexico. I think some people are misled, thinking that most of the grazing happens in northern New Mexico. Not true. Every county, 32 out of 33 counties in New Mexico, have grazing. They are raising animals. It is an agricultural environment, terribly important to our economy. And Tanya has some statistics that we might want to talk about a little bit later about how very, very important this is economically to New Mexico to preserve that agricultural impact.
And we're going to be talking about the event that you just referred to in a moment, called Roundup of Local Flavors, which is happening next weekend. And it's all about meat, you non-vegetarians out there.
Actually, weekend after next.
I think a lot of people, I mean, what does this even mean, progressive ranching?
Progressive ranching is an interest in being good stewards of the land.
And so what are some of the actual
examples
practices
that
are different?
The most obvious one is developing a pattern of rotational grazing. Because in the old days, if you had a pasture that was 20,000 acres and a 500 head of cattle, you'd open up the gate, go,
let them
shoo
out.
Them in. Yeah, shoo them into the pasture and pick them up in 6 months. That doesn't work, because cattle don't have that natural migration pattern that bison used to, or pronghorn still do. So you have to move cattle so that the impact on the land will be much less. Some pastures may see only 3 hours of grazing a year.
But, and that's all they can take.
Yeah, and that has the effect of stimulating the soil, cropping off the old growth of the grasses, new grass comes forward. Good stewardship is what makes ranchers successful. And there's, if you look over the landscape of New Mexico and the number of ranching subdivisions, little ranchettes that pop up, those are examples of people that didn't stay abreast of some of the newest information, the ways to do managed grazing, for example, repair riparian areas, preserve wildlife habitat, because it all fits together in the matrix of the land.
And so you don't see so much of a conflict between ranching and environmentalism as you might have done, say, 10 years ago?
That's right. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Let's turn to Tanya Laveta. You were from Farm to Table. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, Farm to Table was born out of the Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute, which eventually became the nonprofit that's building the building for the permanent site for the farmers market. Farm to Table moved on to start to do some policy work. So we now have a project called the New Mexico Farmers Agriculture and Policy Council. And we've been at the state legislature every year trying to promote different ways to get schools to have more nutritious meals, fresh fruits and vegetables on every plate. We're looking for a legislature this year to be providing funding for that. We also work with tribal communities to help get farmers markets in place there where they're requesting it, from Navajo Nation to the Pueblos. We also do a lot of farm-to-school programming, just doing educational components and helping food service be able to access local producers at this point, getting fresh product to lunch plates.
What, fresh school lunches?
Yeah, imagine that.
Imagine that.
It's an uphill battle, and our food service folks in the schools are dealing with a pittance to try to put food on those plates in general.
Absolutely.
So they really need all of our support for more funding for that. We also have the Southwest Marketing Network, which is a venue for helping farmers and ranchers with their direct marketing, creating strategies and trying to capture some of those niche markets. So this is kind of the other component of what we're doing with this local flavor event is, even if you are a progressive rancher, and so many are out there doing this, sometimes it's really hard to get your product to somebody's table. So we try to help them with different versions of that.
Are there a lot of restaurants in Santa Fe and outside of Santa Fe that use New Mexico produce, whether it be meat or vegetables?
You will see that, and it's a great credit to several of these organizations that we're sponsoring here. But in particular, the Santa Fe Business Alliance with their farm-to-restaurant program. Slow Food Santa Fe has been helping with that. Farm-to-Table has been part of that venture. And, of course, the farmers market here in town has been very supportive. And I bet when I look at that list, it looks like they've probably doubled even in a year about restaurants who are now buying local.
So when we go to the farmers market, say, on a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday morning, are there people from restaurants there, or does it work outside of the market?
You bet. I just talked to one of our farmers who sells to Treehouse, and he says, she's the one person that I don't really have an invoice ready for because she comes to my booth and she buys whatever I have and have to create it by hand. You know, so you will see the chefs there. Unfortunately, it is on a busy day. It is on the Saturday. But a lot of our vendors at the farmers market, they will do deliveries to restaurants after market.
That's a part of what we are hoping to get across with this event, because last year we didn't have any restaurants involved. But this year we wanted to expand it so that people understand that they don't have to buy New Mexico lamb, buffalo, beef, poultry, take it home to cook it. They can also order it when they dine out. And part of what we can do as consumers when we go into a restaurant is ask, you know, what do you have that's local New Mexico produced, New Mexico born, New Mexico raised? We can ask that at restaurants. We can ask that at supermarkets. Walk into your Albertsons and ask them how much New Mexico beef, lamb, poultry they are offering in their beef case or their meat case, and see what the reaction is from the meat market, because if there's a demand, then it will start, we hope, to move that direct marketing effort from the ranches into the meat case and into restaurants.
We actually had somebody on the air last week who had written a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, which was about food movements in the United States. And he said that a guy, I can't remember what state it was in, but he was trying to make a local grilled cheese sandwich. And so he wanted to find locally produced bread with locally produced wheat and cheese and butter. Couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. Now, you have an event coming up, a roundup of local flavors. It's next weekend, September 14th, from 5 to 8 at Alumni Hall at the College of Santa Fe. And all sorts of meat, New Mexican meat, will be served there, and there will be a lot of conversations going on, restaurants, ranchers, producers. What is the, one hears sometimes horror stories about the meatpacking industry. What's the difference between one piece of meatpacked meat, local meat, New Mexico meat? What's going on in the meat world?
Well, it probably goes back to school lunches when you called it mystery meat. At some point,
I remember that.
Yeah. In the commodity market, we have these huge plants that are on the borders of New Mexico, actually, and they process between 1,000 to 2,000 animals per day. Now, if you compare that to our local meat packers, we only have about two of them right now that are USDA certified. They do two animals to six animals. So the kind of care and attention that you see all the way from the ranch, managing animals in smaller herds, to the processing, to the distribution in your table, it's almost handheld. You know, it's very individual and cared for.
And with great respect, what's the difference if it's handheld?
Actually, it comes across in the quality of the meat. Mm-hmm. And it may sound silly, but we teach ranchers, and many ranchers have learned this through other programs, but low stress livestock handling. If you're not stressing an animal, now how do you stress an animal? You make them run, you scare them. And animals can be scared in all kinds of ways. Or you put them into a feedlot with thousands of other animals and you don't give them any, moving room. Or you introduce feed that they're not, really biologically adapted to digest. That introduces stress, and it can change the flavor of the meat. A tense animal, when it goes to the processing plant, in its last few moments, if that animal is scared to death, that translates into the quality of the meat.
And New Mexican ranched animals are not scared before
That's
the
right.
knife is plunged into
That's right. They aren't. They aren't. It's probably not something that you want to do, but I would invite you to go and visit a couple of our processors and understand the humane way that they approach this, very important stage in an animal's life. It's terribly important to them.
What about the issues of hormones, antibiotics, and diet?
It's a very good question. Almost all of our producers will say to you on their handout literature that they do not use antibiotics, they do not use growth stimulants, and they will tell you about any vaccinations that they deem necessary in the process of an animal's life. It's terribly important that these artificial chemicals are not introduced into our food source. We get enough without knowing that we're doing it. With animals. You'll hear all sorts of terminologies at the event, grass-fed, grass-finished, organic, natural, pasture-finished. And a part of this event is to help people understand what those terminologies mean and then get them talking directly to the producers so that those questions can be answered directly so you know where your food is coming from. And that will happen on this event on the 14th.
Well, let's just do one of them right now. Grass-fed versus what? Grain-fed?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Some of the confusion that comes out of these terms is that they've never been defined by the government. Well, you know, it does cause a little bit of a problem because we can't all just open up a book and say, okay, here's what it means. But generally, grass-fed will mean that 80% of the nutrients that that animal has consumed has either been its mother's milk or grass or other forages.
And why is that so much better in terms of the meat that we eat?
Rather than grain-fed? Because animals weren't meant to eat grain. Feeding animals grain was invented after the Second World War. When we had plenty of fertilizer, we could grow plenty of grain, and it's faster to fatten cattle on grain. You can shove them into a feedlot. You can feed them,
is the meat bad for you?
It does introduce, Jo Robinson, if you read her book Pasture Perfect, will tell you that grass-fed beef is higher in beta-carotene, which is vitamin A, in conjugated nucleic acid, omega-3 fatty acids, and that helps to reduce cholesterol, diabetes, cancer, high blood pressure, and other life-interfering diseases.
Grass-fed meat lowers cholesterol,
yes.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. It reduces your calorie intake. An average person might eat, according to the American Grass-Fed Association, might eat about 66 pounds of beef a year. If they substituted just grass-fed and ate it exclusively, they would reduce their calorie intake by about 18,000 calories, which equates to 5 pounds.
Very interesting. We are running out of time, but let's let people know about this event, Roundup of Local Flavors, September 14th from 5 to 8. That's a Friday, week from Friday, at the Alumni Hall at the College of Santa Fe. There's not only beef, but buffalo, lamb, poultry, rabbit. Is there other game animals as well?
No.
So, but rabbit, one of my favorites, a specialty in Europe.
That's
we don't
right.
eat a whole lot of rabbit here.
No. It's one of the restaurants really leaped at the opportunity to prepare the rabbit, so that's going to be great. But we have 14 different producers this year, and even among the beef producers, you'll find those that have different theories of which breed is the best, when they take them to market. So it's just really interesting to connect directly with producers and find out why they feel so strongly that that's the best way to raise their products.
So this is an event to which you do have to RSVP.
It's very helpful. Then we make sure that we have enough of the meats
food,
prepared.
Beverage.
And,
so,
and the number over there is 820-2544.
Exactly. Or you can log on to our website at www.kivira.coalition.org.
And Q-U-I-V-I-R-A. Which
Thank
means,
you.
What does it mean, Kivira?
It means mysterious land of great promise. It's a Spanish word. And in the old Spanish maps, you see it on unexplored areas. And when the organization was founded, it just seemed an appropriate description of the undertaking that those three founders were involved in.
Well, Cheryl Russell is from the Kivira Coalition. Tanya Laveta is from Farm to Table. Thank you, ladies, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg and hear from some of our underwriters. So stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just the voice in the crowd. So I just came home from Petco. Every 3 weeks I go to Petco. I do it for Carl, the cat that's living with us. I don't like going to Petco. I don't like Carl. But the cat has to eat, and you're not going to feed him. I have to feed him, and it's not cheap for these little cans of the salmon and whitefish entree. The cat eats better than I do and lives better than I do. He gets a pedicure nail clip job every few weeks. It all started when my son was coming home from college. He asked my wife if he could bring home an abandoned kitten that a girlfriend of his had given him. My wife said absolutely not. The townhouse we're leasing forbids any pets under penalty of death. So you got it. He shows up at the airport with Carl the cat. Now, we're not only living in fear of being busted, but Carl develops a fixation on my wife's right earlobe. He would snuggle up to her and start nibbling away. We both found it repugnant. Except I noticed lately, when we get into bed, my wife will turn to me with her warm, soft eyes and say, "Where's Carl?" My relationship with Carl is zippo. He positively ignores me. And you have to know, I'm the best valet a cat ever had. I'm constantly opening doors, changing litter, throwing him little fake mice. Ever so often, he'll leap up near me on the couch, and I think, this is it. We're going to turn the corner, establish a relationship. So I tentatively lean my right earlobe towards him, hold out my hand, and throw him a big, warm smile. And he turns and gives me a look like he's about to call the SPCA. I finally decided to call my son and tell him he was going to have to take care of Carl, and he said, no problem. Didn't Mom tell you? I'll be moving home for the next 10 or 20 years. Another mouth to feed.
You can hear Ron every Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, on Thursdays after the noon news, and Saturdays following Bob Edwards.
I'd like now to welcome Carol Oppenheimer and Tomas Rivera of the Santa Fe Living Wage Network. We are here on our Day After Labor Day show to talk about the some of the labor issues affecting Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Now, let's talk about, I mean, the talk of the town for years now in terms of labor in Santa Fe has been the Santa Fe Living Wage. What is the history of living wage legislation in this city?
Well, actually, this is a five-year milestone. I would call it an anniversary. It was about 5 years ago, just about now, that a group of people got together and decided that we would begin to organize to make, and at a grassroots level, organization by organization, individual by individual, to try to put forward the idea that we should have a living wage not just for government workers and government contractors, which we had at that point in 2002, but to expand it so that it would include all businesses in the city. And so we started in around August of 2002 to do that organizing, which led to the ordinance that we're now working under that was passed in February of 2003, which currently covers all businesses with 25 or more workers.
And one of the things that was interesting about this whole process was it brought a lot of people into the conversation who hadn't before really talked about it.
Yeah, that's right. What's exciting about what we're dealing with right now is it brings a lot of business into the conversation, a lot of people representing businesses, workers, and, you know, the community. And throughout the whole campaign up until this point, that's kind of what it's been doing. It's going to be kind of leading up into to where we're at right now.
What have been the hardest and the easiest provisions of the Santa Fe living wage legislation to get to pass?
To get passed?
What did people most object to? What was not so objectionable? To
I
business.
Think, well, actually, interestingly enough, I think when it got passed, almost everything was objectionable to business, because the whole concept that government would be regulating and would have some kind of say over how much money they paid their workers seemed to somehow, for many businesses at that time, to be, and we heard words like socialistic, un-American, nobody has the right to tell me how to pay, what to pay my workers. And it's very interesting because, of course, ever since the New Deal, and even much earlier than that, since we've had child labor laws, since we've had anti-discrimination laws, since we've had a minimum wage law at the federal level, although it's been inadequate, the government has always played a role in setting a bottom line for how businesses should operate. But I would say that the biggest fight from the very beginning, and certainly starting in 2002, 5 years ago, was the sense that the government should have no right to have any say in Santa Fe about what businesses pay their workers. And just to sort of give and then Tomas will maybe talk about some of the other concerns, but on a sort of legal framework issue, basically what we've seen is an incredible turnaround, and I call it un milagro, a miracle, that now we have businesses and Santa Fe Living Wage Network, unions, church groups, other grassroots organizations, groups like the Veterans for Peace, other groups that are only peripherally involved, saying this is what we're proud of what we've done in Santa Fe, and that yes, the government does have some role in regulating this, and that this is an important role for government to set a bottom line for businesses.
How is the economy of the city of Santa Fe responding to the Santa Fe living wage? Have there been studies on that?
Yeah, I'll mention that briefly. I think there is another difficult point that I think Tomas could speak about much better than I could, which is current enforcement problems we're having with the law. But one of the conditions of passing the law originally in 2003 was some worry that because of these predictions of doom and gloom, that the sky was going to fall, that we couldn't sustain a living wage, which, by the way, is the highest living wage of any city in the country right now at $9.50 an hour. In any event, the UNM...
I mean, the sky was going to fall. What was the actual concern?
The concern was higher prices and unemployment.
Okay.
Okay? And so what happened was that the University of New Mexico did a study before and after, when it was before it went into effect and then after it went into effect, and found that indeed the sky had not fallen. And in fact, surprisingly to many people, the area of largest job growth was in the area most directly affected, which was in the hospitality and leisure industry, and that there was no real indication of a raise in prices that was attributable to the living wage. There were problems with fuel costs and weather, just a lot of other issues. But the BBR reports, and there was a before it went into effect, and now there have been two other reports showing that, in fact, the living wage has had a negligible impact on negative impact on the economy, and that the most significant impact was that actually the low-wage workers in our community have actually made more money. And, like, it's kind of a duh. Well, that's what you would think, that would be the case. But, in fact, that's what they've found so far.
What have been some of the problems with enforcement?
Well, we have, because, like Carol mentioned, the law right now only applies to businesses with 25 or more employees. The biggest problem with enforcement that we've run into is that businesses are using that as a loophole in order to avoid paying their workers, to avoid the law, to skirt around the law.
So what does that look like?
What it looks like is people are opening up, people's businesses keep expanding, and they're opening up new stores, they're opening up new restaurants, and incorporating those under different names legally to kind of divide their workers on paper. And so, therefore, they are not legally subject to the living wage. Or they're just saying that they're doing that, or they're, kind of lying and using that as kind of a way to intimidate their workers into not standing up for their rights and into, adding to, like, confusion in order to avoid paying the law the way that it is right now. So the biggest enforcement issue has been the 25-employee threshold.
And, there is another issue, which is the transition from $8.50 to $9.50, and then the next transition to $10.50. What's going on with that? When is that scheduled to happen? Is it going to happen?
Well, by the end of this year, it is scheduled that the council is going to consider what the next step is. And under the current ordinance, it's supposed to go to $10.50 for all businesses with 25 or more workers. But in July, there was a press conference in front of City Hall, attended by representatives from the Chamber of Commerce, the Restaurant Association, the Lodgers Association, hotel owners, restaurant owners, and the Santa Fe Living Wage Network. Union representatives, AFSCME, the New Mexico Central Labor Council were present, New Mexico Conference of Churches, Somos Un Pueblo Unido, a very, very strong partner in this effort to get a living wage. And what was announced at that time was that instead of going to $10.50 an hour for businesses with 25 or more workers, it was proposed, and that is now before the City Council, that we level the playing field for all businesses and all workers so that, in fact, the $9.50 we now have in place would cover all workers rather than what it does now, which is 60% of the workers.
And immediately doing away with all the enforcement issues.
Exactly. The very problems that Tomas was talking about, and what we've found, and we've heard many stories from a number of workers about how unfair it is that some workers are making $9.50 and other workers are making $6.50. And so if it were to go to $10.50, that gap would get even wider. The other thing that is being proposed right now and is before the City Council is that it would be an across-the-board $9.50, essentially a minimum wage, and then also starting in January 1st, 2009, there would be an automatic annual cost of living increase so that we don't erode the value of the $9.50, as we all know has happened at the federal level for, you know, for such a long time. So it's not at all a done deal. We have a lot of work to do, and one thing I want to do is just tell the listeners to please go onto our website, www.santafelivingwage, it's all one word, .org, and you can go on there and get petitions in both English and in Spanish. Please sign them, email us back that you're willing to have your name on that petition. It's a website petition, but please download copies. We'll make sure you get them if you have trouble downloading it, and circulate it among your friends, your neighbors, your the organizations that you belong to. Our goal is to have 2,000 signatures by the time that we go to City Council, and right now we're at about 800. So we just started this a couple weeks ago. So www.santafelivingwage.org.
We're talking to Carol Oppenheimer and Tomas Rivera of the Santa Fe Living Wage Network. I would imagine that the businesses that are under 25 employees, and especially those that are trying to get around the current living wage, are not thrilled about this level playing field.
Well, one of the things that we've run into a lot is a lot of the kind of smaller ma-and-pa kind of places wind up paying the living wage. You know, places with really, you know, 5-10 employees, because they're rooted in this community. They know what it feels like to have to pay these high costs of living here in town. And just, you know, even if that's not the case, because they know that their workers can go and work someplace else for $9.50. It's these kind of medium-sized, upwardly mobile businesses that are really causing the problems, who can definitely afford it, who are keep opening up their shops. And, you know, one of the things that we've been doing in kind of the build-up to this campaign is we've been having little campaigns in specific places, you know, the Sage Inn, Arby's, very public places like that, who are now dealing with lawsuits and having to deal with back pay issues. And, you know, those cases are still pending, and we don't, you know, we haven't seen outcomes yet. Hopefully there will be soon. But we know that businesses are much more supportive of having to pay everybody right away than having to deal with costly litigation issues, having to pay, you know, high-cost lawyers, in fact, just doing something that's right in the first place. And we have a lot of support, actually, from the Chamber of Commerce has signed on to this amendment. The Restaurant Association, the Lodges Association, a lot of businesses and business organizations have also joined into this because it's the right thing to do, and because it's good for economics, it's good for Santa Fe.
I think it's important to point out that $9.50 an hour comes out to about $19,000 a year before taxes, and that as a living wage, it's still kind of borderline. How does it compare to adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage of, say, 30, 35 years ago?
At $9.50 an hour, it probably is, I would say pretty confidently, that would be what the minimum wage would have been if it had kept up with inflation. And so we have actually, within the network, we're not going to change our name. We're called the Living Wage Network. We've had that name for a long time. But we really see $9.50 not as a living wage, but as a minimum wage. And actually, one of the discussions that's now going on in the community as a whole, and we are now working with the Santa Fe Alliance. They by the way, do represent the smaller businesses, the mom and pops, and the local businesses that Tomas mentioned are rooted in the community. And their board unanimously supports this resolution, the $9.50 minimum wage with the cost of living. So we're now talking with them and with other groups about the need for training programs, meaningful training programs, so that workers make more than that bare minimum and begin to move up to get better paying jobs, benefits like health care, which is a whole other issue, and we won't go into it except that the network is very clear that $9.50 does not is not a living wage. It doesn't take into account health care, pension benefits, and the other important parts of you know, being able to support a family here in Santa Fe. And in fact, probably the level, I believe that the wage that is the poverty level wage, where you're above it, is about $18 an hour. It's about double what we're now asking for. But we would, you know, the minimum wage of $9.50 would be quite an accomplishment and something that the whole community could be proud of.
A lot of the lowest wage workers, people who are working for whatever the minimum wage is in any community, in this community, are undocumented immigrants. What is the role of immigration, of undocumented immigration, in this whole set of debates?
Well, the Santa Fe Living Wage Network, you know, my job is to organize workers. And that's what's important to us. And, I mean, that means workers that are from anywhere, wherever they are, whoever they are, whatever they look like. That's kind of what our focus is, and that's the importance of this. The role that immigration plays is that when a boss doesn't want to be paying a living wage or wants to be, you know, is hostile management, they will use that as kind of a wedge to drive workers apart, to help break their solidarity, to stop them from organizing, to intimidate them, and to increase their fear. And we see a lot of businesses using that as a tool for intimidation, a tactic to, you know, of separation. That there's several issues. Young people are dealing with a lot of similar issues out there in the workplace. You know, people who are particularly vulnerable to exploitation in the workplace are those that we're really trying to help here. We're trying to raise the bottom, raise the floor a little bit here in Santa Fe and help workers.
In a community like Santa Fe, when the minimum wage is raised and more of the lowest paid workers are paid a higher wage than, say, in Albuquerque or even in the county, do you then get more workers moving to the city?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, Santa Fe is an expanding city. And I think that, sure, people are attracted to higher wages. The issue is that Santa Fe also has a much higher cost of living than a lot of those other places. So it really is about balancing, and it's about, you know, leveling the playing field. So there is some give, but there's a lot of take as well.
Another issue that comes up whenever the raising of the minimum wage, the living wage, is discussed is what should be exempted. So small businesses last time around were exempted from that. What about young workers and part-time workers? Those are some of the questions that people talk about.
Well, let me just say something put in an historical note, that when we originally proposed this living wage law before it went into effect 5 years ago, we proposed an exemption of 10 or fewer. And the night of that this was passed, which was in 2003 in February, as a compromise to get it through, the number went up to 25. So we now, as we've said, we believe very strongly that we need to make this a fair wage for everybody, and that's why we are very, very strong on $9.50 with no exemptions. And that was the agreement that the Chamber of Commerce has signed on to, that the Santa Fe Alliance has signed on to, the lodgers and restaurant associations. And so we don't want any tweaking. We've done the tweaking. We want it $9.50 with no exceptions at all at this point.
Right.
I would say that we believe that it's the right thing to do. It's a moral thing to do. That it's not going to put good businesses out of business, and that $9.50 there shouldn't be any exemptions for any small businesses. And Tomas may want to talk about the young workers, because he's been working with a lot of young people that are trying to stay in school, and this wage is helping them do that.
Sure. And what we see with any exemption, the exemption that we have right now with the 25 employees, it creates a loophole, right? It creates people have the ability to kind of use that as a way to avoid paying the law. And any exemption is going to create such a loophole. And like you said, some people, we're concerned right now with young people protecting their rights because, like I mentioned before, tend to be particularly vulnerable to exploitation in the workplace. And it's unfortunate. You know, we see a lot of young people who are out there working to help support their families, to help save for college, who are kind of caught in political crosshairs, when really this living wage has been such a help to them, such a help, because it's keeping, you know, they have less hours to work, so they have more hours to spend in school. They have more money to spend on college. It's been really great for working families, and young people are part of that.
And there has also, I've heard, been proposals that part-time workers be exempted. Of course, I would think that one of the consequences of that might be that suddenly millions of jobs are offered at 38 hours a week, and that's considered part-time.
Sure, and, you know, just what you point out, people find ways to skirt around the law. And, you know, any exemption is a way to weaken the law, and it provides a loophole. And any time that there is an exemption, any time there is a loophole, any worker can be caught in it.
There's another issue that you brought up. You mentioned Arby's a moment ago. There are lots and lots of chain stores and chain restaurants in particular that are franchises that you can go to any town, any rest stop along the highway in the United States and see them. Are these considered individual businesses where you can count the number of employees in the teens and 20s?
That's a pretty complicated question. The short answer is that one employer has to count all of their employees in total. So if this employer has one worker in Santa Fe and 30, you know, in anywhere else in the world, that one worker in Santa Fe has to be paid that. So a franchise owner oftentimes owns several franchises, owns two or three, four sometimes franchises.
But the franchise owner is considered the owner rather than McDonald's corporation.
Right. McDonald's corporate isn't the direct employer.
Employer.
Right.
Well, I'll give you an example of a business right here in the shopping center, Party City, as we understand it. It is part of a national or maybe international chain. I just saw in the paper yesterday they're opening more franchises, I guess, in Albuquerque. But as we understand it, they're not paying their workers $9.50. And that's a perfect example of why we want to eliminate all these exceptions, all these loopholes, as Tomas has correctly put it, and make sure that everybody, no matter what the size of the business, gets paid that.
How much of the labor force in Santa Fe is, I mean, you talk about organizing labor. Are you talking about unions? How much of our workforce is in unions?
I don't have those statistics. Carol might be able to answer that.
Well, we have, surprisingly, people think about, we have a very strong number. I can't give you a percentage, but I will say that because we have so many public sector workers in this community, we have firefighters, we have teachers, we have correctional officers, police, and city workers. We have a very, and hospital workers, the workers at St. Vincent are unionized, and the grocery workers at the larger chains. I would say that we have maybe 30-40% unionized. We are a union city, which is something that most people don't think about Santa Fe as a union city, but as more and more growth in the union movement, it's now 36% of all public sector workers are unionized. We are a union city. We have a very strong union base, and we have very, very strong union support for the work that we're doing with the Living Wage Network.
And how organized are the non-union workers in Santa Fe?
Well, I think that they're organized enough to pass really amazing laws like the Living Wage Law, which is, once again, the highest in the country. It's cutting edge. Santa Fe is really a leader in the Living Wage movement. You know, everybody's looking to Santa Fe. Everybody's looking to the city council in October to see how they're going to vote, because this is going to be a national vote, right? So I think that, you know, we're strong, and I think that we're getting stronger every day.
And it's unfortunately time to go, but I'd like to thank you both, Carol Oppenheimer and Tomas Rivera of the Santa Fe Living Wage Network, and the website is santafelivingwage.org. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. And once again, we are moving to 101.1 FM. We're simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. When you go to the new signal, If you have any problems, please let us know by writing to info@ksfr.org. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.